Welcome to the deep dive. If you're listening, well, chances are you're getting ready for the LIBF Financial Services Regulation and Ethics Qualification, the FSRE. It can seem like a lot, the whole financial landscape, but think of us as your guides today. We're here to help you get properly informed.
That's absolutely the plan.
Yeah.
Our mission here is to work through the basics, topics 1.1 to 1.6 in a really structured way. We're following the Future Trend Financial Training Made Easy Guide, step by step. So you should definitely have that guide handy. Use this audio with it. It's perfect for checking your understanding.
We're going to break down, well, everything, really. Why we even have money, what the different asset classes are, how financial markets actually work, and finishing up with something crucial, how the industry tackles financial crime. We want to make these concepts, you know, the ones you need for the exam, really clear and easy to grasp.
Okay, let's jump right in then. Topic 1.1, the role of money. And to really get why modern finance works, we need to look back, way back before coins even, to bartering.
Right, bartering. The original swap shop, basically. Trading eggs for vegetables, maybe a tool for some grain. It worked, I suppose, in very simple societies, but it was quite limited, wasn't it?
Oh, very limited. Because you needed what economists call the double coincidence of wants. Think about it. If you made pots and you needed, say, bread, you had to find a baker. Fine. Mm. But that baker also had to want pots right then and there.
Yeah, and you can see straight away how that just wouldn't work today. I mean, imagine trying to buy a house or even just your weekly shop by trading things you've made. Where would you store it all? How would you even agree on the value? It's just impractical.
Completely impractical. The system needed something everyone agreed had value, a standard commodity, a universal medium of exchange. And that solution, well, that was money. Money is really just agreed upon trust, isn't it? We accept it because we trust the next person will too.
So money does more than just let us buy things. It has these core functions in the economy. The FSRE material highlights three main roles we need to know.
Yes, these three functions are absolutely fundamental. First, and probably the most obvious, is its role as a medium of exchange. It replaces bartering. It's accepted everywhere for buying and selling, so you don't need that double coincidence anymore.
Okay, that makes sense. What's the second function? You said it was maybe a bit more subtle.
It is, but it's vital for structure. Money acts as a unit of account. This is what lets us compare value. It gives us a standard measure. You know, without it, how would you compare a 3-pound sandwich to a 10,000-pound car? But because we price them in pounds, we instantly see the difference in value. It makes pricing and accounting possible across the whole economy.
Right. Comparison. And the third role, something about holding on to value.
Exactly. Money needs to be a store of value. You earn money today, you expect to be able to save it and use its value later on, maybe next year, maybe in 10 years.
But there's a catch here, isn't there? A big one we need to understand for the exam.
There is indeed. A really crucial point. While money keeps its nominal value, a 20-pound note is always a 20-pound note. Inflation can, and usually does, erode its purchasing power over time. What it can actually buy decreases.
And that's not a small effect either. The example in the guide is quite stark.
It really brings it home. If you'd kept 100 pounds in cash back in 2014, but 2024, because of rising prices, that same 100 pounds would only buy what about 74 powers could buy back then. You've lost $26 of real value just by holding onto the cash. That's inflation risk. And it's why the store of value idea always comes with that warning.
Okay, so beyond just being accepted, what makes money actually work well? What qualities does it need? The guide mentions four key properties.
Right. For money to function effectively in an economy, it needs these four things.
Yeah.
First, there has to be a sufficient quantity of it circulating. Too little and trade slows down, too much and you get runaway inflation. Second, it must be generally acceptable. Pretty much everyone has to be willing to take it.
And it needs to be practical for everyday use too.
Yes. Third, it has to be divisible. You need to be able to break it down into smaller units for buying cheap things as well as expensive ones. And fourth, it needs to be portable, easy to carry around and use. That's why we moved from, say, heavy metal coins to lighter notes in our digital forms.
Let's talk practicalities then. In the UK, what money has to be accepted if offered? That's legal tender, right?
Yes, legal tender has a very specific meaning. It refers to certain coins and banknotes that if you offer them to settle a debt in the UK, the person you owe money to must accept them. They can't refuse that specific form of payment for a debt.
But this confuses people because most of the time we pay with debit cards or bank transfers, maybe even checks sometimes. Those are widely accepted, but they're not legal tender.
That's exactly right. And it's a common misunderstanding. A shop, for example, is perfectly within its rights to refuse a debit card payment. They aren't legally obliged to take it, even though they usually do for convenience. They could insist on cash, which is legal tender, for settling a debt. It's more about commercial agreement than legal compulsion for everyday purchases.
And when we talk about money in the financial system, it's broader than just the cash in our pockets, isn't it?
Oh, much broader. Yeah.
Right.
When economists or financial institutions talk about the money supply, they mean physical cash, sure, but also all the money held electronically in current accounts, savings accounts, deposit accounts, and other very easily accessible financial investments. It's the total pool of value that keeps commerce flowing.
Which leads us nicely into the role of the financial services industry itself.
Hmm.
What's its main job in all this?
Fundamentally, its purpose is to make the use of money smooth and efficient. It's like the oil in the engine of commerce and government. It's all about channeling money from those who have it to those who need it.
And there are specific terms for those two groups.
Yes, we talk about the surplus sector. These are people, companies, maybe even governments, with spare money they want to save or lend out, usually hoping to earn some interest or return. And then there's the deficit sector. These are the ones who need to borrow money, maybe to buy a house, invest in a business, or just cover expenses, and they're willing to pay service for it. The financial services industry acts as the bridge between them.
Okay, now let's look ahead. The guide mentions the Bank of England exploring a central bank digital currency, a CBDC, or digital pound. This isn't just theory anymore, is it?
No, it's very much a live discussion. They put out a discussion paper in 2020, and then a more detailed consultation paper with the Treasury just last year, February 2023. The idea is a new electronic form of sterling. Think of it like a digital banknote, issued and backed directly by the Bank of England, sitting alongside physical cash.
And the plan is for ordinary people and businesses to use it for everyday payments. So how is this fundamentally different from something like Bitcoin, a cryptocurrency? That's a key distinction we need to grasp.
Absolutely. Critical difference, yes.
Yeah.
And vital for the example. Let's break it down. Yeah. First, issuer and regulation. A CBDC is centralized. It's issued, controlled, and backed by the central bank and government. Cryptocurrency is typically decentralized, issued by private entities using distributed tech, and crucially, it has no government backing.
So the fundamental trust and stability are completely different.
Worlds apart. That's the second point. Trust. Trust in a CBDC comes from the government guarantee. One digital pound is designed to always equal one physical pound. Stable. Cryptocurrency value. Well, it depends entirely on market forces, supply, demand, and sentiment within its own ecosystem. It can be incredibly volatile. There's no anchor.
And how they're intended to be used differs, too.
Significantly. The CBDC is being designed as stable money for everyday, reliable payments. Cryptocurrencies. Often they're treated more as speculative investments or used for very specific, sometimes niche transactions. Their volatility makes them pretty unsuitable for general shopping, whereas the whole point of a CBDC would be payment efficiency.
Interesting. So it's like a centralized, official response to the decentralized crypto idea.
In a way, yes. And the big question they're wrestling with now is if and how to introduce this digital pound without causing major disruption to the existing commercial banks and the financial system we already have.
Okay, that gives us a really solid understanding of money itself. Let's move on now to where money goes when it's invested. Topic 1.2, asset classes made easy.
Right. So an asset is just anything valuable owned by a person or a business. Could be cash, could be machinery, could be shares. But when we talk about investing, we group these into asset classes.
And an asset class isn't one specific product, like an ISA, but a broader category.
Exactly. An asset class is a group of investments that share similar characteristics and tend to react similarly to market changes. Think of them as the building blocks. Financial products like funds or pensions are then constructed using these asset classes. The four main ones we need to know are cash, fixed interest securities, which are bonds, shares, also called equities, and property.
Let's start with the one we just discussed. Cash. It's kind of the baseline, isn't it?
It really is. Cash is central because everything else is valued in it, and it offers the highest liquidity.
Liquidity meaning you can get your hands on it and use it straight away without having to sell something first.
Precisely. Cash is also seen as risk-free in one specific sense. It doesn't lose nominal value. 100 pounds cash today is 100 pounds cash tomorrow. That makes it good for short-term needs, emergency funds, places where you need quick access and certainty about the amount.
But we know the big downside, that inflation risk we talked about. The real value can go down.
That's the trade-off. Cash offers almost no potential for capital growth, so it's generally a poor choice for long-term wealth building. Especially if inflation is higher than the interest rate you might earn in a savings account, then you're actually losing buying power over time.
Okay, moving on. Next up, fixed interest securities or bonds.
Bonds are basically IOUs, long-term loans. Governments issue them in the UK. We call them gilts to fund spending. Companies issue them too, corporate bonds to raise money for investment. They have a fixed lifespan, often 5, 10, even 30 years.
And if I buy a bond, how do I make money from it? What's the return?
Two parts. You get regular interest payments throughout the life of the bond. That's called the coupon. And then when the bond reaches its end date, the redemption date, you get the original loan amount, the par value, paid back to you. It's different from shares because it's loan, it has an end date, and you don't own part of the company.
The guide also mentions a short-term version of these, money market instruments, MMIs. What are they?
Think of these as very short-term loans, less than 12 months, sometimes even just overnight. They're used by governments and big companies to manage their day-to-day cash flow, things like treasury bills or commercial paper.
Are they better than just putting cash in a savings account?
Well, they usually offer slightly better interest rates than standard savings accounts. They're considered very low risk and highly liquid, easy to turn back into cash quickly. But there is still a small default risk the issuer might not be able to pay back. And often, you need a lot of money to invest in them directly, so they're mostly used by big institutions, not small savers.
Got it. Third asset class, shares, also known as equities. This is about ownership, right?
Exactly. When you buy a share, you own a tiny piece of that company. Investors buy shares hoping for two things: capital growth, share price goes up over time, and maybe dividends, which are a share of the company's profits paid out to the owners, the shareholders.
And unlike bonds, shares don't have an end date, and they aren't loans.
Correct. No fixed maturity date, and the company doesn't have to pay your initial investment back. Share prices can go up and down a lot, depending on how the company's doing, the economy, market trends. If you want to sell your shares, you need to find another buyer in the secondary market.
Okay, fourth class, property. How does property generate returns?
Again, two main ways: rental income from tenants and capital growth if the property's value increases over time. We usually split this into residential property houses and flats people live in, including buy-to-let investments and commercial property, like offices, shops, warehouses.
Commercial property often sounds attractive for income, but it has a big issue.
Yes, illiquidity. That's the main problem. Commercial property can provide steady rent and might be less volatile than shares, but selling it can take a long time, months, even years sometimes. It's hard to turn back into cash quickly. That's why most people invest in big commercial properties indirectly through collective investment funds, rather than buying a whole office block themselves.
So what are the main downsides of property investment overall?
Well, besides being illiquid, property values can be hit hard by economic downturns. Businesses close, people lose jobs, vacancies rise, rent disappears. Plus, buying property involves high costs, stamp duty, legal fees, ongoing maintenance, management fees if you rent it out. It's expensive to get into and expensive to run.
And the guide stresses that choosing the right asset class depends entirely on the investor's situation.
Absolutely. It's all about matching the investment to the person's goals, how long they plan to invest for, and how much risk they're comfortable with. Someone needing money soon or who's retired might stick mostly to cash or very safe short-term bonds. A younger person saving for retirement decades away might choose shares, accepting the ups and downs for potentially higher long-term growth. Someone needing regular income might look at bonds or property for the yield or rent.
Now, all this buying and selling happens within an economic system managed by a key institution, the Bank of England, the BOE.
The BOE is the UK's central bank. It's been around since 1694, though it was nationalized in 1946. Its main job is maintaining financial stability. And it does this through six key functions that, yes, you definitely need to know for the exam.
Okay, let's run through those six functions. What's the first one?
First, quite simply, it issues banknotes. It makes sure there's enough physical cash available for the economy to function smoothly. Second, it acts as the government's banker. It holds the government's main accounts and manages its borrowing needs, essentially lending the government money when needed to cover spending.
And its third role puts it right at the heart of the banking system.
Yes, it's the bank for banks. All the main high street banks, like HSBC, Barclays, NatWest, hold accounts at the BOE. Major payments between these banks are settled through these accounts. This gives the BOE huge influence over the money markets.
Okay, number four relates to policy.
It advises the government on economic matters and monetary policy. Most importantly, it sets the official bank rate, the key interest rate that influences borrowing costs across the whole economy.
And number five, something about reserves.
The BOE manages the UK's currency reserves that includes our holdings of gold and foreign currencies. This is important for international trade and confidence in the pound.
And the last one, the famous one that stops banks collapsing.
That's the lender of last resort function. If a major bank faces a sudden crisis, like a run where everyone tries to withdraw their money at once, the BOE can step in and provide emergency loans. This helps prevent panic spreading and potentially bringing down the whole financial system. It's a crucial safety net.
And you mentioned its influence on interest rates. How does setting its own rate ripple through the economy?
The BOE's Monetary Policy Committee sets the bank rate. It's the interest rate it charges commercial banks for overnight borrowing. When the BOE changes this rate, it directly affects the cost of funds for all banks. They then tend to adjust the rates they charge their own customers for mortgages and loans and the rates they offer on savings. So it's the primary tool for managing inflation and economic activity.
Before the BOE existed, the guide gives a nice bit of history about early banking.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. Back in London, goldsmiths were the first bankers in a way. They had strong rooms to keep gold safe. People started leaving their own cash and valuables with them for safekeeping. The goldsmiths realized people only ever took out a fraction of their deposits at any one time, so they started lending out the rest, issuing paper receipts, early banknotes, and charging interest. That's basically the foundation of how modern banking works.
Okay, that history leads us into topic 1.3, financial markets. We've got money, we've got assets. Now, where do they meet?
A market, well, it's just any place or system could be physical, like a stock exchange floor, or just a digital network where buyers and sellers meet to trade things, in this case, financial instruments. The basic dynamic is always the same. Sellers want the highest price possible, buyers want the lowest, and a deal only happens when they agree on a price somewhere in the middle.
And that price is constantly pushed and pulled by supply and demand.
Absolutely fundamental rule. High demand and low supply for something. The price goes up. Think of shares in a hot tech company. Low demand and lots of supply. The price goes down. Simple as that.
So where do supply and demand ideally meet?
They meet at the equilibrium point. That's where the amount sellers want to sell exactly matches the amount buyers want to buy. This sets the equilibrium price. But crucially, in most financial markets, this point is constantly shifting. Prices are fluid, moving all the time as supply or demand changes, unless something's regulating the supply.
The guide says we can think about financial markets in two ways, personal and institutional.
Yeah, that's helpful. At the personal sector level, think about the interest rate as the price. In the savings market, you, the saver or the lender, and the interest rate is what the bank pays you. In the mortgage market, you're the borrower, and the interest rate is the price you pay.
And then there are the big, complex institutional financial markets.
Right. These are the huge networks where the big players, banks, pension funds, insurance companies, governments, trade vast amounts of shares, bonds, derivatives, currencies. They do this mainly in the secondary market to manage their cash flow, hedge against risks, or borrow large sums.
It's interesting how some prices are fixed by institutions while others dance around based purely on the market.
It's a key difference. Take a base rate tracker mortgage. The price, the interest rate, only changes when the Bank of England officially changes its rate. That's an institutional link. But the price of, say, BP shares, that changes every second based purely on who wants to buy and sell right now. That's market-driven.
Okay, let's look at how these markets are structured. The guide gives five ways to classify them. First, by time the maturity of the deals.
We split this into short-term markets, also called money markets, and long-term markets, known as capital markets. Money markets are for borrowing and lending for less than a year, often just overnight. Essential for banks managing daily cash needs. Think interbank loans, treasury bills.
And capital markets.
Those are for longer-term borrowing and investment, anything over a year. Often much longer, like 20 or 30 years. This is where bonds and shares are traded. So money markets are about immediate liquidity. Capital markets are about long-term funding and growth.
The second classification is about the customer size, retail versus wholesale.
Yes. Retail markets deal with individuals and small businesses. Smaller transactions like personal loans, mortgages, savings accounts. Wholesale markets are for the big players. Large companies, governments, other financial institutions, transactions are huge, often millions or billions.
And wholesale deals usually have tighter margins, narrower spreads. Why is that?
It's down to economies of scale. Processing 100 million roll is much cheaper, proportionally, than processing 1,000, 100,000 pound mortgages. The admin cost per pound is tiny on huge deals, so banks can operate on much smaller profit margins in the wholesale market.
Third classification, risk, secured versus unsecured borrowing.
Secured borrowing means the borrower puts up an asset as collateral, usually their house, for a mortgage. If they can't repay, the lender can take the asset. This makes it safer for the lender, so they charge a lower interest rate. That's why mortgages are generally cheaper than other loans.
And unsecured?
Unsecured borrowing means there's no collateral. The lender is just relying on the borrower's promise to repay based on their credit history. The risk for the lender is much higher. If the borrower defaults, they might get nothing back. So interest rates are significantly higher. Think credit cards, personal loans.
Fourth distinction, primary versus secondary markets. This is key for how companies raise money.
Absolutely. The primary market is where new securities are issued for the first time. So when a company sells shares to the public for the first time in an initial public offering, IPO, that's the primary market. The money goes directly to the company. The secondary market is where those shares or bonds are traded after they've been issued. This is what most people mean by the stock market.
And why is a healthy secondary market so important for the primary market?
Liquidity. Simple as that. Would you buy shares in an IPO if you knew you could never sell them again? Probably not. The secondary market provides the place for investors to buy and sell existing securities easily. Knowing you can sell later makes people willing to buy in the primary market in the first place. It allows the primary market to function.
And the final classification is by currency.
Straightforward. Domestic markets trade in the country's own currency, so pounds sterling here in the UK. Foreign currency markets, Forex or FX, are where different currencies are exchanged. These are enormous global markets, essential for international trade and investment.
Great structure. Now let's dive into topic 1.4, looking at some specific markets, starting with the interbank market.
The interbank market is where banks lend large amounts of money to each other, usually for very short periods overnight, up to maybe 6 months. It's generally unsecured, meaning no collateral. Its whole purpose is for banks to manage their daily liquidity, making sure they have enough cash on hand to meet all their payment obligations each day.
This market had a huge shakeup after the financial crisis, with LIBOR being replaced.
Yes, a massive change. LIBOR, the London Interbank Offered Rate, used to be the benchmark for trillions of pounds worth of loans and derivatives worldwide. But it was based on banks submitting estimates of their borrowing costs, and it got caught up in manipulation scandals. Trust collapsed, and it was phased out by the end of 2021.
So the UK now uses SONIA. Why is the sterling overnight index average better?
SONIA took over fully from January 1st, 2022. The key difference, and why it's seen as much more robust, is that it's based on actual overnight interest rates paid in real, verifiable wholesale market transactions, not estimates. This makes it a genuine reflection of the risk-free rate for sterling overnight borrowing. It's transparent and harder to manipulate. Plus, you can mathematically compound it to work out reliable rates for longer periods, too.
Okay, second market. The bond market. This is for long-term debt.
Exactly. This is where governments issue bonds, gilts, to fund public spending or manage the money supply, and where companies issue corporate bonds to finance things like building new factories or research. Because bonds pay a fixed income, generally, shorter-term bonds are seen as less risky than long-term ones, so they usually offer a lower interest rate or yield.
And credit ratings are really important here. Agencies like S&P.
Hugely important. Oh. Credit rating agencies assess the risk of the bond issuer defaulting. They give ratings, typically from AAA, safest, down to D, already in default. Bonds rated BBB or higher are called investment grade, seen as relatively safe. Below that, BB down D, are junk bonds or high yield bonds, much riskier, higher chance of default.
What happens if a company's bond rating gets cut, say, from investment grade to junk?
It has an immediate impact. The market sees it as much riskier. Investors will demand a higher interest rate, yield, to compensate for that extra risk. Now, because the bond's coupon payment is fixed, the only way for the yield to go up is for the bond's price in the market to fall. So a downgrade typically leads to a drop in the bond's price.
Third market, the equity market, trading ownership.
Again, remember the two parts. The primary market is for new share issues, IPOs, or companies raising more capital. The secondary market is where existing shares are bought and sold between investors. Most activity happens here, and its health is vital for the primary market to work, providing that essential liquidity.
And in the UK, the main place for this is the London Stock Exchange, LSE. What does it do?
The LSE is more than just a trading platform. Its key functions are helping companies raise capital through IPOs, rights issues, etc., supporting the wider economy by efficiently allocating investment capital, and providing investor protection through setting listing rules and monitoring trading activity, potentially suspending shares if needed.
And if UK investors want to buy shares overseas, the guide lists some key global indices.
Yeah, it's good to be aware of the main ones people track. In the US, the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the NASDAQ Composite.
Mm-hmm.
In Japan, the Nikkei 225. In Germany, the DAX. And in France, the CAC 40. These give a snapshot of those major international markets.
Next, foreign exchange markets, or Forex. This is purely about swapping currencies, right? Not borrowing.
Exactly. No lending or borrowing happens here. It's purely the mechanism for converting one currency into another, like pounds into dollars or euros into yen. The main players are banks, central banks, and large financial institutions. It's a massive 24-hour global market.
And why do people need to exchange currencies? Three main reasons.
Yes. First, international trade. If a UK company buys goods from the US, it needs dollars to pay the invoice. Second, short-term investment. Maybe a large fund sees higher interest rates available in Australia, so they convert pounds to Australian dollars temporarily to earn that higher rate. Third, long-term investment. Buying shares in a foreign company, setting up a factory abroad, or buying property overseas all require converting currency.
Okay, final market in this section, insurance and reinsurance. Let's define insurance first.
The insurance market is basically a risk transfer mechanism. Individuals or companies pay a fee, the premium, to an insurance company. In return, the insurer agrees to pay out compensation if a specific bad thing happens, a fire, a car crash, a theft. You transfer the financial risk of that event to the insurer.
But insurers face huge risks themselves, especially from catastrophes. How do they manage that? That's reinsurance.
Precisely. Reinsurance is effectively insurance for insurance companies. Insurers spread their own risks by buying insurance from other insurers, called reinsurers. They essentially sell off parts of the policies they've written. So if there's a massive event like a hurricane causing billions in damage, the cost is shared among many insurers and reinsurers around the world. This stops individual companies going bust and keeps the whole system stable. The original policyholder, though, only ever deals with their primary insurer.
That market overview flows nicely into topic 1.5. The function and operation of financial services in the wider economy. We're back to connecting savers and borrowers.
Yes, the core concept of intermediation. You have the surplus sector, people with money to save lend, and the deficit sector, people who need to borrow. The financial intermediary, like a bank or building society, stands in the middle. It borrows from the surplus sector, paying them interest on deposits, and lends to the deficit sector, charging them a higher rate of interest on loans. The difference, the margin, is their profit.
But why do we need them? Why can't savers just lend directly to borrowers? The guide talks about four problems intermediaries solve, the four transformations.
These transformations explain why banks are so essential. First, geographic location transformation. Banks connect savers in one part of the country or even the world with borrowers somewhere else entirely. A saver in Edinburgh could be funding a mortgage in Bristol.
Okay. Second is aggregation transformation. That's about size.
Exactly. Most people save relatively small amounts, maybe a few hundred or thousand pounds. But borrowers, especially for mortgages or business loans, need huge sums. Banks gather millions of small deposits together to create the large pools of capital needed to make these big loans.
Third, and this sounds tricky, is maturity transformation.
This tackles the mismatch in timing. Savers usually want access to their money relatively quickly, maybe on demand or with short notice. Borrowers, however, need money for long periods, like 25 years for a mortgage.
Mm.
The bank bridges this gap. It lends long-term using short-term deposits, managing the risk that too many savers won't demand their money back all at once.
And the last one protects the savers from individual defaults.
Yes, risk transformation. If you lent your £1,000 savings directly to one person and they didn't pay you back, you lose everything. Banks lend to thousands of borrowers. They expect a few will default, but they build this expected loss into their calculations and spread the risk across their entire loan book. This diversification protects the individual saver's deposit.
So the opposite, when borrowers and lenders connect directly, is disintermediation.
That's right. Disintermediation is when they cut out the middleman. For example, a large company might issue bonds directly to investors. In these cases, a bank might still be involved, but they act more as an arranger or advisor, charging a fee for their services, rather than making a profit from the interest rate spread.
Okay, let's look at the institutions doing this. We need to know the difference between proprietary and mutual organizations.
It's all about who owns them. Proprietary organizations, like most big banks, think Lloyds, Barclays, are owned by shareholders. These shareholders buy shares, hope for dividends from the profits, and get to vote on how the company is run. Mutual organizations, on the other hand, are owned by their members, not external shareholders.
And the classic example of a mutual in the UK is a building society.
Exactly. For a building society, the members are usually the savers and borrowers. It's run for their benefit. Since the Building Societies Act 1986, they've had the option to demutualize, basically, convert into a bank, a PLC, owned by shareholders. Some famous names like Halifax did this. Demutualization often allows them more freedom to operate and raise capital.
The guide also mentions credit unions.
Yes, these are important too. They're also member-owned financial cooperatives. Usually, members share a common bond. Maybe they work for the same employer, live in the same area, or belong to the same trade union. Credit unions play a really valuable role in tackling financial exclusion, often offering basic savings accounts, affordable small loans, and financial education to people who might struggle to access mainstream banking.
Looking inside banks, their activities are often split between retail and wholesale.
Right. Retail banking is the high street stuff, dealing with individuals and small businesses, handling deposits, making personal loans and mortgages, running payment systems. Wholesale banking involves much larger transactions with big corporations, other financial institutions, and governments. Banks often raise large sums of money in the wholesale markets to fund their retail lending activities.
And building societies can use wholesale funding too, but there's a limit.
Yes. They are generally allowed to raise up to 50% of their funding from wholesale markets, though legally it could go up to 75% under certain conditions. However, they traditionally rely more heavily on retail deposits from their members.
After the 2008 crisis, a major safety measure was brought in. Ring fencing. What does that mean and why is it important?
Ring fencing came from the Financial Services Banking Reform Act 2013. It forces the UK's largest banks to legally separate their core retail banking services, taking deposits from individuals and small businesses, operating payment systems from their riskier investment banking, and international wholesale activities. The importance is huge. It protects ordinary savers' deposits. That money inside the ring fence can't be used to fund risky trading activities, nor can it be lost if the investment banking arm collapses. It prevents taxpayer bailouts of the investment side using retail deposit money.
That protection relies on money moving efficiently, which brings us to money transmission and the clearing process.
Money transmission just refers to all the ways money moves around. Paying in cash, writing checks, less common now, setting up direct debits, making electronic transfers like faster payments or BACs. The main tool for most people is their current account, which allows payments in and out, usually with an overdraft facility. Competition means many basic accounts are free, though banks often charge fees for accounts with extra benefits, like insurance.
And all these millions of payments between different banks need to be settled up at the end of the day. That's clearing.
Exactly. Imagine all the payments flowing between customers of NatWest and customers of Barclays all day. Instead of millions of individual transfers between the banks themselves, the clearing system calculates the net amount owed. So if NatWest customers sent 10 pound meters to Barclays customers and Barclays customers sent 8 pound meters the other way, NatWest simply owes Barclays the net difference of 2 meters. This final settlement happens through the accounts the banks hold at the Bank of England. It's much more efficient.
And making sure this whole payment system works well and fairly is the job of the payment system's regulator, PSR.
Yes, the PSR. It's an independent body, actually a subsidiary of the FCA, set up in 2014 and operational since 2015. Its main goal is to make sure the UK's payment systems, the infrastructure behind cards, transfers, direct debits, are accessible, reliable, secure, and represent good value for money for everyone who uses them.
It has three specific legal objectives.
That's right. One, promote competition in the market for payment systems and services. Two, promote innovation in payment systems. And three, ensure that payment systems are operated and developed in a way that considers and promotes the interests of service users. The PSR's work is vital because, well, if the payment systems stop working, the whole economy grinds to a halt very quickly.
That regulatory oversight is crucial as we move to our final topic, 1.6, financial crime, a really serious area for anyone working in finance.
Absolutely. Financial crime is a broad term covering criminal behavior related to money or financial markets. Think fraud, insider dealing, financing terrorism, and of course, money laundering. The FCA has a specific definition covering fraud, dishonesty, market misconduct, handling proceeds of crime, and financing terrorism. Importantly, it includes acts committed abroad that would be illegal if done in the UK.
And this isn't just a UK problem, it's global.
Definitely. The UK works closely with international bodies like the Financial Action Task Force, FATF, which was set up back in 1989 to combat money laundering globally. The FCA actively monitors financial firms here to make sure they have systems in place to prevent financial crime, protecting both consumers and the integrity of the markets.
Let's look at specific types. First, fraud. What's the main law here?
The key legislation is the Fraud Act, 2006, alongside older laws like the Theft Act, 1968, plus various company and tax laws. The Serious Fraud Office, SFO, handles the biggest, most complex fraud cases, but the FCA's role is to ensure that all the firms it regulates have strong procedures to prevent fraud happening in the first place.
Then there's the big one, money laundering. What's the core idea?
Money laundering is the process criminals use to disguise the origins of money they've made illegally from drug trafficking, organized crime, whatever. They filter this dirty money through legitimate financial products or businesses to make it look clean or hide where it came from. The main UK law is the Proceeds of Crime Act 2002, POCA. We also now have the Sanctions and Anti-Money Laundering Act 2018, SLA, which is particularly important for regulating sanctions and terrorist financing after Brexit.
And the FCA is tough on firms that don't take this seriously.
Very tough. They scrutinize firms' processes, especially how they deal with high-risk customers or products. The guide gives a good example related to mortgage advice. A criminal might use dirty cash, maybe with a small mortgage, to buy a property. Then they sell the property relatively quickly. The money from the sale now looks like legitimate property proceeds. That's why mortgage lenders and solicitors have strict legal duties to check where the buyer's funds actually came from, the source of funds.
Okay, another area is bribery and corruption.
Covered mainly by the Bribery Act 2010. Again, the SFO often leads investigations, but the FCA can, and does, take action against regulated firms if they're found to be using bribes to win business, or even if they fail to prevent bribery by people acting on their behalf. Firms need robust anti-bribery policies.
The guide includes a really stark example of a money laundering fine to show how serious this is.
It does, and it's worth highlighting. In April 2019, Standard Chartered Bank was fined over £102 million by the FCA. This wasn't for a one-off mistake, but for serious and prolonged failures in its anti-money laundering controls over several years. One of the most shocking examples mentioned in the findings was the bank allowing someone to open an account and immediately deposit the equivalent of £500,000, £500,000 in cash, brought into a branch in a suitcase. And crucially, the bank failed to adequately check where this money came from.
Wow, £500,000 in cash in a suitcase and not enough checks. That's exactly what the rules are designed to stop.
Exactly. It shows a fundamental breakdown in the expected controls. That huge fine was a very clear message about how seriously the regulator takes these obligations. Financial firms are seen as the gatekeepers, the front line against financial crime.
What a comprehensive journey we've taken. We've gone right from the basics of why money replaced bartering through digital currencies, asset classes, how markets like the LSE and Forex function, right up to the crucial role of regulation and fighting financial crime.
We really have covered the foundations. The functions of money, the characteristics of cash, bonds, shares, property, the different ways markets are structured, the vital role of intermediation, clearing systems, and the regulations like ring fencing and anti-money laundering rules. Definitely go back to your Made Easy guide now, review these sections, make sure those key terms and concepts are locked in. It's essential groundwork for the FSRE exam.
So reflecting on all this, what's the big takeaway?
I think it's the sheer interconnectedness and the level of trust required in the whole system. Everything we've discussed, from the Bank of England providing stability to ring fencing, protecting deposits, to the PSR ensuring payments work. It all creates the environment where complex finance can happen. It allows your savings sitting in a bank, perhaps combined with thousands of others, to fund someone else's mortgage, maybe someone you'll never meet. So here's something to think about. Of all the regulatory points we covered, maybe the shift from LIBOR to SONIA, the impact of ring fencing, or this potential move towards a CBDC, which one do you think will ultimately have the most significant, maybe even disruptive, effect on the UK's financial landscape in the years to come? That's worth mulling over.